I'm James St. James. This is Night Fever, nightlife legends of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond. I am joined, as always, by my co-host, the co-founders of World of Wonder, the fabulous Fenton Bailey, and the radiant Randy Barbado. It's good to see you both.
Good to see you.
Our guest today is a singer-songwriter, producer. She is a longtime LGBTQ icon. She's a dance music legend. More than that, she is probably one of the greatest voices the music industry has ever known. She is a force of nature, to be sure. Welcome to the show, Martha Wash. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm very good. Now, you all have met each other before, haven't you?
Well, yeah, because I did work with RuPaul, and I was one of the judges on Drag Race quite over 10 years ago.
It was the Morgan McMichaels and Sahara Davenport lip sync, and they did it to your Carry On. And mm-hmm. I know that Rue has said what a special episode that was, because that song is what got him through after his mother had passed away.
Right.
And that he listened to it over and over.
Yeah, he had told me about it.
It must be such a special feeling to know that you are a part of so many people's, you know, the music of their lives.
It's rewarding in that people can connect with the music that I put out, you know, however it makes them feel, they just kind of lean into it, you know, and so yeah, that is rewarding.
Can I just add to this that I actually, to this day, if someone has gone through something difficult, or I know someone's having a hard time, or to this day, I send them Carry On, because yeah. I remember, you know, back when Rue's mom passed and him hearing that story back then. But I also just, so I am so grateful for you and your music and your voice. But also, I originally met you, I believe, in 1997 or 1998 on a video. You were making the video for It's Raining Men with Rue in like Brooklyn somewhere. I think it was raining.
It was in New York City.
Was it in New York City?
Yeah. Yeah. In one of the studios, yeah.
I remember seeing, we're all going to go through our, where we first saw Martha. because I remember 2 Tons of Fun at the Copa in Fort Lauderdale.
Oh, God, yes.
And then I think Weather Girls were at Backstreet in Fort Lauderdale when I was probably 16 years old. And just, you talk about the soundtrack of your life. I mean, that's...
Yeah, Copa was the place down there in Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah. I grew up in Fort Lauderdale, so I was there from a very young age. That was my...
That was the place to go.
You were born in San Francisco.
Yes.
I want to start in 1976, which I imagine in San Francisco, it was just gay pride every day in the 70s. And you auditioned to be the backup singer for the late, great Sylvester.
Yeah.
Tell me about that audition.
I didn't know that I was going to audition for him. A friend of mine called me and said that they were having auditions at this particular address and that I may want to check it out. And I went, and come to find out, it was for Sylvester. And I had seen him probably 2 years earlier, but I didn't know who he was at the time, and saw his show because he was the opening act for Billy Preston. I was a huge fan of Billy Preston, and saw Sylvester, and I said, oh my God, who is this guy? I had never heard of him. And I really enjoyed his show, enjoyed the band and everything, and went on and had fun listening to Billy Preston. And fast forward two years later is when I met Sylvester.
At the audition, was it instantaneous? Did you know that you were clicking? Did you just get that vibe that it was a relationship that would work?
No, I was just going in there to audition. I thought initially it was to audition as a studio singer, you know, a session singer. But he was there and he was looking for background singers. And there were two white thin girls that were there. And when I came in, they were still there. I introduced myself and told him I had seen him 2 years prior at a Billy Preston's show. We chatted for a couple of minutes and then he said, you know, go on in and let me hear you sing. And come to find out, the guy that was playing the keyboards or the organ for him at the time was a dear friend of mine. We had grown up together in church. So I knew him, his family, the whole thing. I said, what are you doing here? He said, well, I'm playing for him. You know, I said, okay, cool. And so I auditioned for him and it finished and went to the restroom. And when I came out of the restroom, the girls were gone. And Sylvester and I talked some more. And he said, can you find somebody else that's as large as you are and that can sing? And I said, yeah. And brought in Izora because we had sung together prior in a gospel group. So I knew her. And that's kind of how it all started.
You performed around town a lot at legendary San Francisco clubs like the End Up and the Stud, the Palms. Do you have specific memories of that period and what those clubs were like? Because a lot of them were after hours and probably a little crazy.
No, they weren't after hours, but they were small and tiny. The Palms on Polk Street was a regular place that we played. We would play there maybe two or three nights a week, depending on the month. And the other place that we played quite a few times was the Elephant Walk.
Oh, right. Okay. Over on in the Castro. Yeah.
Exactly. And we would do the afternoon shows over at the Elephant Walk. At the Palms, we would do, like I said, two or three nights. And sometimes we would do two shows a night, usually. And so that's how we kind of developed our audience. And it was just fun, especially at the Palms, where it's a small club, but they had windows next to the front door. And so the front door would be open, but also the windows would be open as well. So people would not necessarily be walking back and forth on the sidewalk. They would be watching from the windows. They'd be standing in the windows watching our shows and stuff. So it was, because if you couldn't get in, all you could do is...
The cheap seats.
Yeah, exactly. Watch from the windows and stuff. Yeah.
Did Sylvester, was he friends with Harvey Milk at this time? Did you know Harvey?
I didn't know Harvey personally. I knew of him. I don't know if they were friends. I'm not sure. They probably could have been.
Was Sylvester still in the Cockettes?
Oh, no.
No, this is after that.
This was, we came long after the Cockettes.
Mm, okay.
I'm saying, just guessing, probably at least maybe 10 years.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah.
He had moved to Europe and was living in Europe and performing. And then he came back to California. And that's when I and Izora, we came on.
Did you guys like come down to LA and do like Catch One, or did you tour around in those days?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Miss Jewel. Yeah. We used to do the Catch One in, it was another, well, look, you got clubs. They change their names every 2 weeks or so. Same place, but different name, you know? So yeah, but we played a lot of different clubs in LA.
And then did you do, in New York, did you do like Studio 54 or Hurrah's or Xenon, all those places?
Yeah, a lot of Bonds International, Limelight, Red Parrot, big ones and small places. Yeah.
And do you have specific memories of that, or is it all just pretty much a blur?
I remember playing Studio 54, and the only reason why I said that, well, naturally because of all the hype, celebrities that would come out and all of that stuff. But I remember being afraid to perform on that bridge because the bridge moved.
Oh.
And it would be stationary until you came on. And sometimes the bridge would move forward out over the audience while we were performing.
Oh, no.
Tricky.
When You Made Me Feel Mighty Real came out and mm-hmm. you did the circuit of Merv Griffin and Dinah Shore and all those shows, that must have been sort of a heady time for you. It must have been just a whirlwind, I imagine.
It was fun. It was fun doing the TV shows. I think we did Dinah Shore when she was down at Busch Gardens. That was fun. You know, just going out and doing our thing and being background singers for Sylvester.
You also performed like alongside the Village People and the Commodores. Yeah. I guess would all probably be on the same circuit.
Sometimes.
I'm curious. Wait, I have a question. Because doing that, well, actually, not just the Sylvester circuit, but later on as you were going out with doing your own thing. And you have done the club. You've performed in clubs a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever go to a club when you weren't working?
Yes. Good question.
I figured, right?
No. I liked the club. Well, let me take that. Well, okay. I went to the clubs more so before I started singing with Sylvester. When I had like turned, I was getting in clubs before I was 21, so don't tell nobody. But anyway, because Izora used to work at a club. She was a bartender. And so there was a one particular club in San Francisco that we would all go to, and that was a club called Bojangles, which was also, that was on Larkin Street in San Francisco. But it was a gay club, again, small. But that's where we would go and have fun and dance. But after I started singing with Sylvester, not so much. The only time we would close out a club is if we were in Houston at, God, what's the name of it? It'll come to me in a minute. Very Riches. Is it Riches?
Yes, it is. Was it Riches? It's Riches.
But then didn't they move downtown? It wasn't Riches. It was another one because Gene Howell and Gary Smith owned the club, and they had two clubs, one in Houston and one in Beaumont. It'll come to me. But that was the only club that I would close out because we would have so much fun. They would have the drag, we would stay after our for the drag shows and then dance the Cotton Eye Joe and just have fun. But that was about the only place where I would help close out a club.
In 1980, you and Izora started Two Tons of Fun.
Mm-hmm.
Was he supportive of that move?
I think he was happy, but I think he wasn't happy as well. Only because I think he thought we were leaving him, you know.
Mm.
But he got over it. He got over it. Because Harvey was the one who suggested it. Harvey Fuqua, our producer. He said, I think you guys should record an album. We said, okay. You know. And we did the first album. It did well. We had some good singles off of it. And started going out and doing a few shows, even though we were still singing background for Sylvester. Sometimes we would open up for him. And so that's how it kind of progressed. I think it was more so when I decided to move to New York that I think he got upset with me, you know, like I was leaving him behind, that kind of thing. But he eventually got over it.
So in 1982, we were talking at the top of the show about when It's Raining Men came out. And I remember so specifically those opening chords and just that feeling of euphoria in the club when everybody would run to the dance floor and throw their arms in the air and sing along. And it was such a moment in time, because 82 was also, you know, Do You Really Want to Hurt Me? It was Tainted Love. It was like Humanly. There was this feeling that the gay culture was sort of breaking through, and that you were very much at the forefront of that. Do you remember performing for some of the first few times you performed It's Raining Men and the reaction it got?
I think. Actually, I don't remember necessarily us performing it where I got that excitement from it. I think what it was when Paul Jabara would come to one time in particular, Club Heaven in New York City. And he came to our show. We had just finished our show. And he had acetates under his arm. And it was copies of Raining Men. And he went to the DJ and asked the DJ to please play the song. And the DJ played the song. And when the song started, there was just all this screaming and hollering and yelling and folks going up, you know. So that was kind of a clue for us, you know what I'm saying? And that we'd maybe have a hit.
It was a hit.
It was such an outrageous song, too. Like, when you first were recording it, were you ever like, oh, my God, this, you know, because it really kind of hits the nail on the head, right?
I didn't necessarily want to record it.
Oh, and I love it.
Yeah, I told Paul, I told Izora, I said, you got to be kidding. You know, I don't think anybody's really going to buy this song. You know, I think Izora was kind of skeptical too. And I said, Paul, you really, are you serious? He said, yes, I need you to record this song. And he literally begged us to do it. And I said, but Paul, I don't think anybody's going to buy this song. He said, I need you to record this song. He said, this song is going to be a hit. I know it. And he said that Barbra Streisand turned it down. Donna Summer turned it down. Diana Ross turned it down.
Wow.
Cher turned it down. And so now, thinking about it, you know, 40 years later, stop and think about Barbra Streisand singing It's Raining Men. Okay, just use your imagination, right?
And Cher, I mean, each one would put a whole different spin on it. But
exactly.
But thank God you did it. And thank God that Paul Jabara had the sense to push it, right?
Yeah. He literally pleaded with the song was finished. Mm-hmm. The song was finished. And all it needed basically was the lead vocals.
That first bit where you say, hi, it's your weather girls, and have we got news for you? Was that ad-libbed? Did you do that on your own? Or did Paul write that in? Because it feels so...
I think Paul wrote that in.
He did?
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about Paul Jabara, because he's a legendary character, too. Tell the kids who Paul Jabara was.
Oh, God. Paul Jabara was many things. But he was a singer, songwriter, producer, actor, just I didn't really know a lot about Paul, but I would guess he was a theater guy. I would just guess he was a theater guy, you know, that loved show business, that whole thing, you know. And so by the time I met Paul, he had done a lot of things. And remember the movie, Thank God It's Friday. He was doing that and wrote the songs for, wrote some of the tracks for the, you know, for the soundtrack. So, and he, I can almost guess that Paul was a theater kid growing up.
His songs are larger than life, big, big storytelling songs that, that feel very theatrical. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Your debut album, Martha Wash, right? It was a self-titled album.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where Carry On was from. Is that where that one was?
Yes.
Yeah. And that went to number one. And then Give It to You, which also went to number one on that.
Mm-hmm.
But right after that is when the like Black Box thing happened. Am I correct?
Yeah.
I don't know if this is something that you are, you know, you've probably talked about it a million times. But that first time when you realized that everybody had your vocals and they weren't, they didn't credit you, or is that when there was the French model, Catherine?
Catherine Quinault,
yeah, who was lip syncing to you. What went through your mind as you realized that your vocals had been used without your permission?
Okay. I'll condense a lot of this. I didn't like it. I saw the video. On TV, I was in a hotel room scrolling through the channels and came upon a music video station. And I happened to hear my voice before I looked at the TV because I was doing something else in the in my hotel room. And I turned around and looked at the video and just watched the whole video. And I said,
what in the hell?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I couldn't believe it.
Nobody had given you a heads up that this was coming.
No. I didn't know a thing about it. And so I called my manager. He was in his room, and I called him and told him what I had just seen. And we called my attorney and told him what we had seen or what I had seen. Uh-huh. And so he started reaching out to the producers and stuff. And we went on from there.
Was the producer of that, was that David Cole? Or was
no,
he the CNC? That was CNC?
Black Box are the Italian producers.
Mm-hmm. Right, okay. The frustration of this, I can't even imagine just seeing, hearing your voice and it's not coming out of you. It just boggles my mind. And but you sued for commercial appropriation.
Yeah.
And then there was a settlement, though, that sort of seemed to work in your favor a little bit.
Right. RCA, who distributed Black Box, the music in the United States. They said, well, why are we dealing with them when we have the real person right here? So they offered me a record deal, and that's where the first Martha Wash album came out. So yeah, it was after Black Box.
They also said that they would underwrite your tour, and that there was a few records, wasn't it?
Yeah, I did two, because the second one was on Logic, one of their boutique labels. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you get through that, you get through the Black Box incident, and then all of a sudden, CNC Music Factory does the same damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that one was with, it was Gonna Make You Sweat, and it was Zelma Davis who was performing. Now, so what happened? What do you do again? How did you discover it?
On TV again, basically. Yeah. And I'd said what you said a few minutes ago, what the hell? and started kind of going through the same process again, although I had known David because he was our musical director for the Weather Girls with our band and everything. So I knew David, had worked with him previously, and he had offered me a chance to work with his production company. And I said, no, I mean, you know, thank you, but no. And so, when Sweat came out, it was like, why would you do something like that? You know,
in a world full of straight people, aren't you glad there's WOW Presents Plus, the number one place in the world to see Drag Race? And so much more. Subscribe to WOW Presents Plus. Still only $4.99. Subscribe today as streamed on TV.
Was it malicious though, or was it? Did he realize he was sort of screwing you over, or was he just thinking, I have these vocals, I might as well use them?
Well, I've always, and it's always just been a, what's my word? Only my opinion.
Yeah.
But I thought the record company had something to do with it. And kind of like a big part, because they had this group called Sensi Music Factory, which was Zelma Davis and Freedom Williams, and a group called Trilogy. Well, with Sensi Music Factory, Gonna Make You Sweat was their first single. And it really hit. And so naturally, from a business standpoint, the record company is saying, you need to take advantage of it. It's a hit. You know, I know you're trying to finish the album, but go take advantage of this song. Promote it the hell out of it, you know. So they took it and ran with it. And so when this thing happened, it was like, well, yeah, the song is a hit, but who you see singing it is not the person who actually sang it. So, you know, steps had to be taken again.
You sued this time for fraud, deceptive packaging, and commercial appropriation. And you won, and they had to put the disclaimer on the video.
Yeah.
Right. When they played it. Yeah.
Yeah. So in essence, what you see now is an artist or whoever, whether it's a music video or a musical track, you see the artist's name, and if there's somebody else working with them, that other person has to be on there as well. So you have artist A featuring artist B.
Mm.
You didn't see that before.
So that's how one of the ways that you changed the industry.
It became a kind of legislation.
But then I you must have sort of mended fences, because didn't you tour with CNC Music Factory and record other things with them?
I did wind up working with them on their second album.
Okay. So yeah. It was water under the bridge, or was there sort of...
You move forward.
Yeah. Look,
you sue, you win, or you lose, and you move forward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that does sort of seem to be the path through your whole career, is just keep on going.
Keep moving.
Carry on.
Exactly. Exactly.
You've collaborated with Rue a number of times, like we were talking about. And the first one was in 97 with It's Raining Men.
The sequel, yeah.
Tell me how you met Rue and how that all came about.
I don't actually remember how I met Rue. It could have.
Weren't you on the original RuPaul talk show? Before Drag Race. That's when you guys first met. I believe Fenton and I were there around for that. But so you guys go way back.
You're right. And we had done, we would be on the same shows sometime, depending on where we were. Yeah. But yes, you're right. The talk show. Yeah, exactly.
You know, Randy, that talk show, I wish we could go back and see those episodes again. There were so many fantastic people on that.
Legend.
It was a lot of fun.
It was fun. Absolutely. Yeah. It was fun.
You also did in 2014, you did Can I Get an Amen for...
Right.
On his album, More Naked album. Yeah. So you and Rue just are old chums at this point.
I see him every once in a while.
He's such a huge fan of yours.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And it's so funny. I don't think anybody would have guessed that Drag Race would have been going this strong after all these years. I think it was probably a surprise to you guys.
I know. I mean, Ruth's 62. And, you know, he says it. He's not shy. You know, he's, Fenton's mic isn't working.
Fenton, you were just asking about the difference in the different eras of music and dance music and navigating that.
Yeah, and what the scene was like in, say, comparing it in San Francisco with the height of disco versus like the mid 90s and all that.
Are you just talking about the evolution of the sounds of music from the 70s to like to the 90s or what? Because I'm not quite sure.
I mean the atmosphere, what it was like, not so much the music, but just the whole kind of club scene and the
I want to say there were more clubs in the 70s and 80s. I think as time went on, there became less and less disco clubs. There were still clubs, but there weren't as many, and there weren't as many dance clubs. The music changes, the styles changes and everything. And that may have been a part of it. People came together. They went to clubs, but they didn't do as much dancing, I want to say, as time went on, together.
Did the audience change?
Yeah. Well, yeah, they got a little older. I mean, you know... Sure. I think there were differences, but more so the music as opposed to the people. You know, people came out to have fun, but not, I want to say not like they did in the 70s and the 80s and things, you know, because there were less clubs.
Yeah. Fenton, what other questions did you have stockpiled?
No, that was the main one. And like I guess how the music changed, you know, how you felt the music changed too.
Then you started having so many subgenres of particular types of music. That started a whole thing, you know, whereas with disco music, all of those remixes and stuff that you hear now, they weren't out there like that in the 70s. You know, it was the 40, not 45 version, but the album version, you know, more so remixes came much, much, to me, in my opinion, came much, much later with different versions. And even now, songs that you hear that were originally recorded in the disco era, those still came later because some DJ heard this song and said, I can make this song different. I can remix it into a more now style, depending on what era that was, 80s, 90s, 2000s, you know. But that kind of music, the original versions and stuff, came out in the 70s and the 80s.
I imagine, too, just the whole process of getting a song to chart or getting a song out there was... You know, in the 70s, it probably involved a lot more touring than in the video era of MTV or something like that.
Well, yeah, because you didn't have videos. So what you had to go out there and do was promote the song. people heard the song on the radio and may have seen you perform it on a show on TV. But when, what they say, video killed the radio star, you know, when you see a video of the song that you heard on the radio, you see it in front of you on a TV, then that's more enticing.
Do you still enjoy touring? Do you still get that same sense of immediacy?
Well, yeah, because you have the audience immediate feedback. It's a little bit harder because I've gotten a little bit older, but it's still fun because you're meeting new people, going to places that you may not have ever played before, you know, cities and things. So that's fun too. And just hopefully getting new fans who a lot of them may have never heard of my music per se. They maybe were too young or weren't even born yet, you know. But now with, you can find music everywhere. And I have had people tell me, I found your music on this such and such a platform, and I really, really like it, you know. So that's the great thing about these different music platforms and things now. You can find just about anybody that you like and find new ones that you become fans of.
It's sort of an awkward question, but do you understand, like, on a daily basis, that you are like an icon, an LGBT icon? Is that something that, like, that when you go to the grocery store, do you, I'm Martha Wash? Do you ever just think to yourself, that I've influenced people? No.
I've always just considered myself a working woman.
Yeah.
Really. Yeah. I've been an ally with the LGBTQ plus community for 40 years now. But, and even before, it's just been something. What I do is just, you know, what I do, and hope people that hear and see me, realize that I'm real in what I do, in what I say. I, as far as the community is concerned, I've always felt like, why are they treated different when they shouldn't be? You know, we're all human beings. We all have our struggles or whatever. If you don't like a certain group of people, okay, that's your opinion, that's fine. But don't try and throw your views and your position onto everybody else and expect them to like it, because they're not. And that actually goes both ways, even with the gay community as well. We should all be able to live and talk. And if either side does not agree, cool. But continue to live your life however you live your life, and be a citizen, allowed to be a citizen of this country. Whether you were born here or not, you're here. And whoever you are, be who you are, and allowed to be who you are. And anything other than that, I feel is wrong. So I've always stood with the gay community.
I always have felt that you were a part of the community, and that you were somebody that everybody has always just, you've been around. You've been mother. You've been our aunt. You've been our best friend.
I'm the cool auntie.
You're the cool auntie. Yeah, but just that support and knowing that you're always there has always just been, I think that's what I was getting at with that. I hope you know how much you are loved and how much people appreciate all the 40 years of being with us.
Yes.
You know?
My God, I'm still standing. Oh.
we're all just barely standing.
But you know what? Look, in all the good and the bad, I always tell people, I said, look, if I'm looking at you and you're looking at me, it's a blessing to still be here. Okay. You know, whatever the things that you wish you could have or that you don't have, or for the ups and downs and stuff, look, be glad that you are still here, because if you live another day, there's always hope.
And when you think about, you know, going through, you know, post Stonewall in the 70s and then AIDS in the 80s and 90s and what we're facing now with the, you know, Republican opposition and,
right,
you know, the things, right, that are happening in Florida, you know, we will get through it and we all have to get through it together.
Exactly. Exactly. It's a struggle and it's always a fight where there shouldn't be. That's the thing. That's my feeling, where there shouldn't be a fight, you know. Don't give me your dogma and expect me to swallow it, because I'm not. I know different. I believe different. So, you know, the ones that scream the loudest, sometimes I kind of give them a side eye. Okay. You know.
Do you think in your history of seeing this struggle, do you think it's ever changed? Like, and do you ever see a point where there won't be a struggle?
I'm hoping for a day where there won't be a struggle. But it seems like it's a long way away, only in that they keep chipping away at what you have now. You know, they keep chipping away at that. You get from point A to point B, but then they start chipping away at point B again to get you back down to point A, you know? So that's the struggle. That's the struggle. And it's ongoing. It's continuous. I think until, maybe I'm not saying this the right way, but until a lot of people die off, you know, will things start to kind of get to where you can get to point B again and then continue on to point C.
Well, that's hope for the future. If the children will lead the way, right?
Well, yeah. Right. Yeah, because it seems like a lot of the younger ones aren't necessarily paying attention to the older ones. The younger ones have got their own minds. They've got they're learning their own set of values and looking at the world in a much broader space and inclusivity.
Yeah.
Whereas the older ones had become, even though I'm old, the older ones had become more narrowed in their thinking. That's why I think of the young people, their mind is more expanded than some of us now and some of us older, you know, where they don't care. Look, if I like you, I like you. And that's how I've been about that. You know, it doesn't matter to me. If you're a good person, then cool.
You have been for the past, maybe 10 years or so, you've been touring with the First Ladies of Disco,
yeah.
Evelyn Champagne King, Linda Clifford, Norma Jean Wright.
Mm-hmm. The ladies who are with me now are Norma Jean Wright and Linda. When we originally started, it was Evelyn and Linda and myself. It's because it's kind of like a rotating show. So people come in and they leave and somebody else comes in. Yeah, we've been doing this. God, I can't believe it's 10 years now. But yeah, and it all stemmed from a book called First Ladies of Disco. And the author by the name of James Arena, he was the one who actually wrote a series, 6-part book collection of dance music. starting with the first book, which is First Ladies of Disco, on to First Legends of Disco, DJs and producers, European artists. So it's a great span of music from 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s, where people who are really into music can get a wide swath of information, from artists to DJs to producers to all of that. And it all comes in like a 6-book set, a collection that you can find on Amazon. But we decided, James Washington and myself, who's my manager, decided that we were going to expand on the name First Ladies of Disco and start a group. So that's how it all came to be. So we just finished our tour, actually our first tour last year, which it was interesting. It was fun. It was work. But the audiences who came out had a ball.
Yeah, a ball. I can imagine.
Yeah, because it takes you back to, for a lot of people, their teenage, young adult years, where they're just getting into the clubs, you know, being able to get into the clubs and stuff, or listening to the music on the radio at that time. And it brings back a lot of memories. A lot of memories, you know.
So you just finished the tour, and is there? Will you be recording soon? Will you be touring solo? What's coming up?
Oh God! Hopefully, we'll be going back out and working First Ladies of Disco. I still haven't even promoted my Love and Conflict album because I was working with First Ladies of Disco. But, and hopefully I'll be able to do that maybe sometime this year, but it's just a lot of things I'm got going on and dealing with the Purple Rose Records and stuff, which is your
record company.
Yeah, that's my record company. And, we really do need to get back in the studio and do another single. So hopefully, depending on everybody's schedule, possibly later on this year, towards the end. We'll see what happens.
Well, Martha, it's been so wonderful having you here. It's been a delight. I'm so glad. I feel bad for Fenton that he didn't get a chance to say anything.
I'm sorry, Fenton.
No, thank you. It's just a delight to hear your stories. And you know, I just really to say thank you for all you've done. I mean, James, you are, as James said, you are so beloved in not just the LGBT community, you're just beloved. You are a legend. Well, and
hey, I appreciate it. I just kind of do what I do and hope that people like it, love it, dance to it, cry to it, however it makes you feel.
Yeah.
That's it.
Well, never stop ever, ever. I want you to be 105 and still touring, okay?
Oh, that's going to be interesting. Okay. I appreciate
it. We will wheel you out on stage and put a microphone in front of you.
Or a walker or something.
We'll just wheel the whole bed. We'll wheel a hospital bed on stage and you just let you go.
Exactly.
Thank you.
That is so funny.
Well, thank you again so much.